This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The author of the book Ancient Brews speaks today at Western Michigan University. Coming up, Andy Robbins will talk with Patrick McGovern. He's an archaeologist at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. But first, how much do incentives offered to companies to locate or expand their operations help create jobs? Tim Bartik, senior economist for the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo, spends a lot of his time trying to figure that out. His latest report is called Who Benefits from Economic Development Incentives? Tim Bartik, thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
The last time you were in, we were discussing a previous report on economic incentives being targeted when they actually tip a decision one way or another for a company locating. How is this focus a little bit different? Are you now looking at what happens once that company locates? Who gets the benefit of those jobs?
Right. This report is looking at what are the benefits and costs of these incentives in terms of higher or, for that matter, lower incomes of state residents and local residents. We devote a lot of money to these incentives. They cost over $40 billion a year. It's about what states collect in corporate income tax revenue. And the relevant issue is, are the incomes of state residents any higher as a result? And what the report really tries to focus on is not just the sticker price of incentives, the $40 billion, but also what an economist would call the opportunity cost of incentives, which means that $40 billion is not a free lunch. There's no fairy godmother or Bill Gates who is paying for what a state devotes to incentives. Someone in the state is paying that $40 billion, either higher taxes on someone or lower spending on some public service. And there are economic consequences of those higher taxes and lower spending that must be taken into account in doing a full benefit cost accounting of these incentive programs.
So is there a way that you have seen that makes sense where you can structure incentives in such a way that those costs are worth what you get in return in terms of economic development?
Well, there are two guidelines. One, you need to really target these incentives so that you limit the ones that go to firms which have a low multiplier effect or a relatively low wage. And by a multiplier effect, I don't mean anything magic. I simply mean that one rationale potentially for these incentives is you incent one firm and it has local suppliers, perhaps, in the same state or same metropolitan area. In addition, the workers at the firm, if they're paid enough, will go out and buy a lot of local goods. So there are these multiplier effects. I mean, they typically might be 2, 2.5, maybe 3. When you say a multiplier of 2, you mean for every one job you incent, you get one other job, total of 2. If you can get multipliers of 4 or 5 or 6, these things can definitely pay off. The other issue is how you pay for them. And one of the things this study really emphasizes is that if you pay for incentives by cutting back on productive services such as education, that's a really bad idea. It's a really bad idea because one of the key things that drives long-term economic growth in an area is the skills of your workforce. Now, this doesn't affect things immediately. You cut back on education, say, of kindergartners, they're not going to the workforce at age 5. There's not an immediate huge economic loss. But down the road, when people are entering their prime earnings years, a lot of those folks, that's your future workforce. If you're not investing in it, the economic development cost of cutting back on education vastly exceed the short-term economic boost you might get from attracting a firm today. So you have to be very careful about not only how you structure these incentives up front and targeting them in a careful way, but also about how you pay for them. What services are you cutting back? And if you're cutting back productive services, you're in big trouble.
So are you better off then if you are developing some sort of economic development program to say, if we're going to offer tax incentives to this company to move them in, we are going to raise taxes on other companies in order to pay for it?
Well, in some cases, it actually can pay off. One of the more surprising things about this study was that I found that actually, in terms of alternatives for financing the incentives, one of the better alternatives is raising taxes in other businesses. And that may seem odd because, after all, the whole rationale for these incentives is that costs matter, and it might seem strange to say, how on earth can it pay off to lower taxes on some business and raise taxes on others? Well, The basic idea is that your tax incentives lower taxes on businesses that sell their goods and services to a national market, that are what regional economists call export-based businesses or tradable industries. They're industries that trade not just with foreign countries, but around the U.S. They're bringing new dollars into your economy, and they have multiplier effects. And we know that such companies have choices about where to locate, whether they're going to locate in this state or in some nearby state. They're selling to a national market. They have choices. They're more sensitive to taxes than businesses that sell locally. I mean, if you look at, say, fast food restaurant employment, that's largely driven not by taxes. It's driven by what's the total number of people living in the area and what's their income. It's not going to be driven by the taxes that fast food restaurant, on the margin. Obviously, at some extreme, it would be driven by taxes. But, you know, within a reasonable range of tax rates, that's not what's driving the number of jobs in fast food restaurants. But on the other hand, for so-called export-based companies that sell to a national market, taxes are a more important factor. And these are also, you're targeting companies that are making investment decisions in the here and now, whereas there are a fair number of companies that are just kind of going along and they're not really thinking about new investment decisions at a given point in time. The other factor is that this report is very much focused on what are the effects on state residents of incentive policies. And when you raise tax on other businesses, you're exporting some of your tax burden to out-of-state residents who generally, you know, most, you know, companies are owned by stockholders. Stockholders live all over the U.S. or, for that matter, all over the world. And so there are some advantages to exporting some of your tax burden. I'm not saying you want to take this to an extreme and say that we want to offer these huge tax incentives and just raise business taxes very, very high. But on the margin, if we did feel that we wanted to finance these programs in a better way, rather than cutting education, I think you'd be a little bit better off raising overall business taxes slightly.
So when you look at who benefits from some sort of economic incentive that we assume actually does tip the balance, as we say, and brings a company in or creates an expansion, is it likely to be people at the lower end of the income scale, the upper end of the income scale, somewhere in between?
It depends crucially on how you finance it. If you finance it through increased taxes, and if the multiplier effects are high enough, then in fact, the benefits tend to be somewhat progressive. They tend to benefit groups all across the income spectrum. And as a percentage of income, people on the lower end of the income spectrum would tend to do somewhat better. They would tend to do somewhat better because if you really do have high multiplier effects, you've really targeted this, increases in the employment to population ratio benefit most the people who are most likely to be unemployed. And that tends to be people on the lower end of the income spectrum. On the other hand, if you finance these incentives by cutting back on education significantly, one of the public services that does the most to help equalize the income distribution, obviously it doesn't totally equalize it, even if that were feasible, but it does help quite a bit, is public education, which delivers benefits to a wide variety of income groups. So from the viewpoint of low-income folks, working-class folks, providing incentives to companies and financing by cutting back an educational service that will help their kids succeed long-term in the labor market makes absolutely no sense. And in fact, in some of the estimates I do in this report, I find that you can have an economic development incentive program that might pay off overall for all income groups, but if it's financed by cutting back on education, it would seriously hurt people in the lowest income groups.
One thing that you suggest in this report is that governments who offer these incentives might consider front-loading them. In other words, putting all the incentives up front as opposed to stretching them out over a number of years. What's the benefit of that?
Well, a couple benefits from front-loading. One benefit is we have a lot of studies of how businesses make investment decisions, make location decisions. And given the way the stock market works today and given the pressure on business executives to meet quarterly profit targets, there's a lot of focus on the short term. It's very unlikely that a tax abatement, property tax abatement, in year 11 of your investment plays any role whatsoever in location decisions. So why on earth are you offering it? Well, there are some political reasons for offering it. Namely, there are some advantages to a state politician, a legislator or a governor or a local politician, a mayor or a city council, of giving away your successor's tax base. Then it'll be your successor's problem to deal with the revenue thing. So there's some reasons why people do it. Those aren't good reasons. Those are good political reasons, not good economic reasons. So the reason for front loading is it probably has a higher bang for the buck. You affect location decisions at a lower fiscal cost. Now, you do have the problem if you give incentives up front. What if the company leaves after 3 years or whatever? And so then you have what are called clawback agreements, which can be written in as legally enforceable agreements that you basically say, we're providing you this incentive today in exchange for which you agree to provide so many jobs for the next 10 years. And if you leave after 5 years, we prorate it or whatever. And so you can work out the exact provisions of that. The other aspect I think about it is this is one way of providing a budget constraint on these incentives, too. If they're provided up front, then you have to pay for it immediately.
Are there other incentives that you would also want to offer? You mentioned something in the report about, for instance, customized job training. Is this, when you're talking politically, does that have the same cachet as a tax credit or a tax incentive, a tax abatement? You know, does it have the same ring politically that that you would get out of saying we're going to, you know, give somebody a tax break?
Well,
to move here?
No, unfortunately, it does, because it doesn't get the same kind of publicity. And I don't, you know, $4.5 billion for Foxconn or $8 billion for Amazon attracts a lot of attention from the public. It attracts a lot of attention from the news media. I mean, I get lots of phone calls from reporters asking me about Foxconn or Amazon.
But if somebody were starting
this is
job
actually
training,
one of the few times reporters ask me about customized job training. So you're distinguishing yourself here and asking about it. Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of evidence that these services, particularly services to small and medium-sized businesses, locally owned businesses, can be quite effective. In other words, you offer customized job training. The idea is you're offering a service that costs the government X dollars to provide, and the service might be more valuable than that to the company. It might be worth Y dollars. You're giving them, particularly if it's a smaller company, they may not have the resources to offer the kind of job training they'd really like to offer their employees, may not have the expertise in how to run job training programs. And if they work closely with a local community college, they can set up a program that has a higher bang for the buck than simply handing out tax incentives. And it can make a big difference to a company's competitiveness. And there are a number of studies that have looked at this that find this, that in some cases they find that, say, customized job training might have an effectiveness to cost ratio of 10 to 1, that it's 10 times more effective than handing out tax incentives per dollar.
One of the things you say in your report is that there are short-term political barriers in place here to doing economic development the way that you prescribe. Is that always going to be the case, that it's if you are the governor of a state and you watch the governor of another state offer a big incentive and they get to do the ribbon cutting, that's going to affect your decision-making?
Well, it is. I mean, I don't know what to say except that I think the public, the news media, different interest groups have to try to resist the lure of the short-term and debate the long term. We always need to be talking about not just, we need to try to the extent we can to allow people to focus on the big picture and the long term. We need to say, look, attracting this firm today might provide some jobs right now, but if we're paying for this by reducing our investment in education, that's going to have major costs 20 years down the road. We have to think about our kids, our grandkids, and what kind of local economy and local society and local community we're leaving them with. And if you say, well, look, we live in the short term, we have to survive now and get jobs now, well, yes. So I'm not saying you totally eliminate tax incentives. If you target them on the highest multiplier firms and the highest wage firms, you limit their costs and maximize their benefits. And if you invest in customized services to small and medium-sized businesses, if you help your local manufacturers become more competitive through manufacturing extension, if you work with local small businesses and help them expand, you provide some customized job training, you can provide some immediate benefits and job creation at a cheaper cost. So, you know, I'm not saying you don't do anything in the short term, but you need to be very careful in financing and paying for the short term that you're not sacrificing your long-term future.
Tim Bardick is senior economist for the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. His latest report, Who Benefits from Economic Development Incentives, can be found at upjohn.org. You can also find a link to that report at wmuk.org. Tim Bartik, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.